Thanks for pressing play. If you love the serendipitous magic that can only occur in a real conversation, you're in the right place. This is Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different, the number one real dialogue podcast for business leaders, entrepreneurs, and category designers with a different mind. Every parent and every person who cares about children and their development is going to love this episode. You see, over 1 billion children are victims of what our guest calls adverse childhood experiences, from all forms of abuse, from food deprivation to racism, hostile environments, and more. The developing brains of young people make the effects of this kind of trauma more damaging to both their mental and physical health. Today, we're joined by educator, neuroscientist, and former Harvard professor of evolutionary biology and psychology at Harvard, Dr. Mark Hauser. He's here to talk about his new book, Vulnerable Minds: The Harm of Childhood Trauma and the Hope of Resilience. This is a powerful, research-based conversation for anyone who cares about kids. You should also know this is a very adult conversation. We deal with tough topics like childhood abuse. And if you're a regular listener, you know we do have controversial people on. And Mark Hauser, at least to some, is a controversial guy. If you care about the mental health of kids, you'll love this episode. And you might be surprised what you learn about yourself. Before we begin, I need to take a quick second and tell you about the Category Pirates newsletter. If you're an entrepreneur or marketer that's tired of just competing, then become a Category Pirate and design your own uncharted market. The Category Pirates newsletter is your compass through the untamed waters of innovation. Learn from the legendary captains of category design themselves on how to frame, name, and claim new categories. Hoist your sails towards undiscovered riches. Subscribe at CategoryPirates.com and join the crew dominating entirely new markets. Now, as Joey Ramone said, hey ho, let's go.
Well, Mark, it sure is great to see you. How are you, Doctor?
I'm very good. Thank you. And Mark is good, but not the doctor.
I just love people that have these lofty titles. Now, it makes me happy to call you doctor, but I'm also happy to call you Mark. And so I have been spending a bunch of time with your wonderful new book, and I have a whole bunch of things on my mind. But before I jump into any of that, I'm curious, is there any particular place that you would like to start?
I don't think so, in the sense that you know, there are certainly things that are happening in the world today that are very relevant to certain pieces of the book. Although, so obviously things like the wars in Ukraine and Gaza are very topical right now for me, who's interested in both the news and the devastation of what's going on in the Gaza area. And sort of strikingly, and you may have gotten to this chapter, but the chapter on war actually begins with a story about a young child, a Palestinian child, whose entire family was bombed out in 2021. So, of course, the book was written before today, but that section came out of that before the war obviously started. So, of course, that's on my mind just in part because of, you know, what exposure to war does. I mean, we're going to obviously the number of deaths is extraordinarily traumatic, but just exposure to war. So that's, you know, that's certainly on my mind just because it's very relevant. But I work, as you probably know, with a lot of kids who are suffering from trauma of different kinds, both nationally and internationally. And so these topics are on my mind all day long.
Yes. I don't know. Maybe sadly, maybe I shouldn't jump here this fast, but you just kick me under the table if you don't want to. But how do you deal with that? I mean, you're dealing with very young people who I think the vast majority of people with reasonable hearts view empathetically and have a sense of wanting to protect and care for and provide for and to create a hopefully an on-ramp to a wonderful life over time and, you know, sort of parental type feelings that I think most adults have to children, regardless of whether they're their own or somebody else's. And so how do you, as just a person, because you're not a machine. You're not an algorithm. You're dealing with real people. How do you go home at night and enjoy a little bit of the morning show or I don't know what on Netflix?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And it's a good question, and I think in at least two ways. One, obviously, there's the personal one, which because you asked me about myself. But I think it's got a more broader component to it, which is anybody who works with children or adults who have experienced some kind of trauma, they themselves may have also experienced certain kinds of trauma. And trauma-informed organizations have to find mechanisms to take care of the people who work with the people who have got trauma so that they're not exhausted and experience what often is called compassion fatigue or, you know, empathy exhaustion. And I think that's a really important piece of what I do is to, you know, find ways to take care of myself so that the difficulties of the day don't overwhelm me 24 hours a day. And, you know, there are different things that I do. I'm a pretty serious athlete. and that's one outlet for me. I've got an amazing wife who's actually a veterinarian who is extraordinarily empathetic in her own world. And she deals with trauma at a different level, people and pets. And, you know, we have a beautiful, calm, relaxing home that's kind of rural, out in the woods near the beach. And so there's a lot of comfort just in having a serene, calm place to keep myself, you know, there. And so that's one piece. And I think the second piece is exerting a kind of the best level of compassion and empathy towards these kids, whose my heart goes out to all the time, without getting just completely sucked into their universe. Because I can't do the work to help them if I'm going to be overwhelmed emotionally by what's going on for them.
I'm often reminded of that axiom of first responders when charging into a situation. Rule number one, don't make yourself a victim.
Correct. That's right. And I think, you know, I mean, I often compare myself with my wife's work, who's a veterinarian, where, and I remember this early on, where she said, look, when I'm doing the surgery, that thing is a machine and my empathy is not there at that moment. I don't have that luxury. I'm working with living, breathing kids and they need me in that moment, you know, in those moments to be there for them. And I think it's particularly difficult in some of these cases because sometimes, you know, happened just the other day, I may be involved in a physical restraint of a child who's going to either attack me or attack somebody else, and I've got to get physically involved. And those are particularly challenging ones because the message that we always need to give these children is, tomorrow I'm back and it's a new day and I don't hold it against you, even though they may have spit on you and kicked you and even hurt you in some cases. And tomorrow, new day, smile, how you doing? Let's have a good day today. And that's really challenging because that requires a level of compassion and to really take on board this issue of not what's wrong with you, but what's going on inside of you such that these are the ways you manifest your frustration, your anger, your depression, or whatever it is. And so having that lens all day long is definitely not an easy part of the job.
No doubt. No doubt. Thank you for that. So if I sort of start, you know, towards the beginning of the book, it feels like to me as a layman consumer of the work, if you will, that you're setting a lens for us around these things you call ACEs, traces, and races as sort of the foundation from which you then want to take us forward into the thinking and the research. Am I generally getting that right, Mark? Am I tracking so far?
You are. That's very good. Yes.
Okay. So, and I like the little bubbles and stuff. You know, pictures are good for people like me, so I appreciate that.
Good.
And so maybe kind of unpack Aces, Traces, and Races. And they seemed also one can lead to another and it can morph. So let's get into it if you could.
Yeah. Okay, good. So the acronyms, so ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and they have a quite important history and role in kind of setting the foundation for the book in some ways. Some readers may well be familiar with this. I certainly know that from working with some teachers in schools and clinicians and nurses, that there's maybe some familiarity with it. The brief version of it, and I certainly can elaborate more, is that in 1998, Dr. Vincent Felitti and his colleague Robert Anda developed a survey called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire. And it was basically 10 questions about childhood experiences that were adverse, that they deemed adverse, that focused on things that happened within the family. So different kinds of neglect, emotional neglect, physical neglect, different kinds of abuse, physical, sexual, emotional, and then what they kind of labeled broadly as family dysfunction, things like domestic violence, a parent with mental health issues, substance abuse, and so forth. And so there were 10. And people took those surveys and they were saying, did you have any of these experiences before the age of 18? And if you did, you just put an X and you got a score of 1 for that ACE. So ACE scores went from 0, you had none of those, up to 10. The publication that happened in 1998 really rocked in some ways the medical community, because what they did, in addition to the ACEs surveys, they linked it to, or they associated it with, physical and mental health problems. And what they found was that the risk for very, very significant mental and physical health problems, cancer, diabetes, obesity, depression, anxiety, were inordinately higher the more ACEs you had. In fact, there seemed to be almost kind of a risk cutoff where if it was 4 and more, the severity was just through the roof. And this was very reminiscent of what's often called a dose-dependent response that's known from pharmacology and toxicology, that the bigger the dose, at some point, the thing kind of does this little inverted U and it goes exponentially up. Okay. So that became kind of like, wow, that's really surprising. People hadn't really looked at these childhood experiences in that kind of way. And it then became kind of an international phenomenon where the World Health Organization started administering it across different countries. And lo and behold, and perhaps not surprising to some, ACEs were not the province of democracies or dictatorships or one race over another race or this religious group or that religious group or poor or wealthy. ACEs were prevalent throughout the world. The WHO estimates that about 1 billion children per year are maltreated. That is just a numbing number.
Okay. And Mark, remind me, how many children on the planet right now? What we're about almost 8 billion people, is that right?
8 billion. So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, maybe depending on in the 18 range, maybe a third of those are under 18, you know, maybe a little bit more. So maybe, you know, 2.5 billion or so. So we're having, you know, a large part of the children's world are exposed to some kind of maltreatment. Okay. So that really should have sent a major shockwave through literally the universe. And yet, in some ways, it hasn't. I mean, the people are aware of it at some level. But some things happened that I think that limited the impact of what might have happened and I hope is now beginning to happen. One is, in many circles, the ACEs were interpreted as a score for individuals and made their way into policy in certain parts of the world. For example, California. In California, Medi-Cal, which is an insurance policy for low-income individuals in the state, they have a code for ACEs. If you're 0 to 3, you get one code of insurance coverage. If you're 4 or more, you get a different one. But the ACEs survey was never intended as a screener for individuals. And in fact, the science has shown very clearly it's completely unpredictable
And let me ask the maybe obvious stupid question. I assume you pay different amounts depending on your score on aces?
That's the idea, and different treatments as well.
So translation, if I am truthful on my form and I express that I had some, let's just say maybe less than fantastic experience as a child, I'm then going to pay more insurance because of it.
Well, more insurance, but also potentially better, different kinds of treatment as well, services. So,
it's going to cost me more. I may not be eligible for certain things.
Or you may be more eligible for some things because of the risk factors. So it's a little bit of a ambiguous policy. but the key piece for, I think, the audience to know, and I think this is true whether you're an insuring policy person or you're a parent or a teacher or an individual, the ACEs score is not a predictor of health risk for individuals. It's like a population measure. Let me give you an analogy. If we get heritability scores for disposition for alcohol, heritability is not a measure of the individual. It's a population measure. So people who have relatives who have been alcoholics, therefore may have a genetic package that with interactions with the environment may give them a higher possibility of becoming alcoholic. That doesn't say that you are the one who's going to be more at risk. It's a population measure. So heritability, like the ACE score, is a population measure. But perhaps more importantly, and this is where traces and races comes in, it's a measure of experience, not response to the experience. And this is really a critical message. It's a message that is so important for anybody working with individuals who have had adverse experiences, or in my case, kids who have. The same two individuals who've had exactly the same ACE score, John.
Just so that I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So please. Two individuals say they had the exact level of, I don't know, impact, effect from an experience. That's a similar kind of experience. Is that what we're talking about?
We're not talking about the impact. So you've now jumped to the traces part, the response.
Okay. So
I'm going experience.
Okay. So we both have a similar experience. We both had a similar horrible thing happen.
Right. And to make it even more as similar. Okay. You're bringing in one more ingredient. No, you're good. You're good.
I'm
you're
just
awesome.
Trying to understand.
Yeah. No, it's perfect. You're laying out all the things that are the complications, which are the key pieces. Okay. So let's unpack it a little bit. The A score is simply this. It's a number. It's a number of adverse experiences that happen between the ages of birth to 18. If you, let's say, so we've got two people, John and Sally. John has an ACE score of 4 and Sally has an ACE score of 4. In terms of policy, in that insurance policy, they are treated the same, 4. But now let's pull apart some of the differences. John had those 4 ACEs when he was 5 years old. Sally had them when she was 15. John had emotional neglect, physical neglect, mental health of a parent, and domestic violence. Sally was sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally neglected, and physically neglected. 4 different ACEs at different ages. John's, let's say, lasted from that early age for a couple of years. Sally's lasted from that teenage year all the way through until she was 18. The length of it was longer. Sally was repeatedly sexually abused. These are all different dimensions which can have a tremendous effect on the development. But even with that, Sally ends up depressed, anxious, and is totally emotionally dysregulated all the time. John looks completely normal. No problems, no mental health issues, but they have the same ACE score. One has resilience, perhaps due to both biology and the environment. One is very vulnerable, perhaps due to both biology and the environment. So that's where this idea of traces and races comes in. Traces, the acronym is traumatic response to adverse childhood experiences. Races, resilient response to adverse childhood experiences. Ultimately, what we truly care about are the responses to the adversity. The trauma is the scarring of the body and the brain. And that's what we need to understand, because that's how we're best going to help these kids.
Awesome. Excellent. 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 Thank you for that. Okay. So a question I've been really hoping to be able to get to. Let's say we describe in relative detail an ACE event at a particular age range or age, specific age. Is an ACE designation, rating, ranking an absolute? Or is it an interpretation of the person who had the experience? That is to say, two people could have a similar experience. I've had this conversation with my sister, and she remembers something as being very important, either positively or negatively, that I don't remember happening, and vice versa, both on positive and negative things. And so now, maybe it's different on a more traumatic thing, but let me say it this way, without sort of jumping on the table and, you know, getting all into it with you. You know, I have had experiences as a child that I completely forgot about, that for one reason or another showed up in my adult life and I was reminded of it. And there are people who spent like 25 years in therapy over that issue, and I barely remembered it. And when I did, I thought, ah, fuck that. And it didn't, I mean, it was barely gum on the shoe. It might not have been at the time, but yeah. And so you understand my point, which totally. Is an ACE or is an ACE determined by the experiencer, or is it more of an absolute?
Great question. And there's actually multiple questions within that question. So let me take them apart a little bit. So first of all, it's certainly an interpretation by the person filling it out. And that's important for several themes that appear within the book that I think are really important today. One is cross-cultural. What you and I as Americans consider to be physical abuse might not be considered physical abuse in other countries. So, for example, I work in Kenya, very different country, very different culture than ours in many, many, many ways. Physically punishing a child is not seen as abuse. I'll add it more even to another environment. Until 2016, I believe, what was called caning, hitting a kid in school with a stick, was permissible. In our own country, corporal punishment is legal in 19 states. So if you were to ask the physical abuse question in those 19 states, they may not even consider a whack on the head by a teacher or a parent to be physical abuse. I would in Massachusetts, and a child in Massachusetts would. So I often do this in the classroom. I say, with high school kids, I said, so, you know, if we were living in these states and you said something rude to me, I could literally whack you on the head and I'd be completely defended by my school. And they're like, yeah, go ahead and try it, right? These are those kids, right? Come on, bring it on, right? So that interpretation piece is both relevant culturally, cross-culturally, and it's relevant to the actual individual, right? If I grew up in an environment where my dad slapped me when I spoke out of turn or whatever, it's part of what I grew up with, and like, I guess that's the norm, right? Okay, the same thing is true with neglect. An even trickier part of the ACE score, okay? I grew up, what do I know what a neglectful parent is? My mom never read to me. We never got to go out. You know, the food was very limited. That's my universe. And then I go to college and I'm like, wait, excuse me? Your parents read to you? I'm like, what the heck? Where I got a bad deal. So And that's very relevant to me personally, but also what appears in the book. So our younger daughter, wonderful, wonderful young woman now, we adopted from Russia. And she was in an orphanage up until the age of two and a fairly austere environment. And so for those first 2 years of life, there was a lot of experiences that a child growing up with biological parents who are very nurturing, because it's not just the adoption versus the biological parents that's necessarily the key distinction, but a nurturing where those attachment, those relationships are being built very early on. She didn't get that. And some of the best things we know about how neglect or deprivation impact child development comes from these very, very difficult to digest studies out of Romania with the Romanian orphanage studies that have been ongoing since the 90s up until the present, where we now know in great detail all the impact that that deprivation has depending on the timing, coming back to your earlier question, of when it occurs, how long it lasts, how severe it is. So that interpretation of the ACE score is fundamental in terms of both the individual experiencing and then how it manifests, if it does, in a traumatic response.
Okay. And
that was a lot.
maybe there isn't an answer, which is totally fine. If I were to sort of very accurately and descriptively, in as generic a way possible, describe some horrible experience and say, if you had this experience, tick X. And then say, if you had this experience and you experienced it as a significant traumatic experience, tick Y. Or is it, if you had this experience, you had an ACE?
Yeah. So the original survey is the last option. If you had this experience, if you were hit, kicked, bitten, you know, slapped, you got one.
Okay.
Right. And importantly,
without interpretation, if you were hit as a child by any adult or anybody, if you got hit as a child, tick yes. Okay.
Tick yes. And importantly, and I think this is particularly relevant to, and I bring this up in the book, in the case of sexual abuse, you may recall this during, you know, the heat of the Me Too movement, Matt Damon said, the actor, you know, don't we want to distinguish between an off-color joke and being raped? And he got taken to task for that comment, given the timing. You know, probably rightly so. It seemed insensitive. On the other hand, we know from various studies that the severity of the sexual abuse, and again, that's open to interpretation, but rape versus a poor sexually off-color joke has a very, very different impact on the person who was being abused, who was abused. And that's important. It's one of the dimensions that I point to, sort of toxicity, I call it, which is the severity of it. It's really important to distinguish those. And yet in the ACEs questionnaire, it's not. It's simply sexual abuse. Inappropriate touching is no different than being raped.
Yeah, so if I could just, well, it's on my mind. Yeah, so
sure.
In the verbal stuff, it is subject to interpretation and context. Now there's right. Some things that are more or less, you know, subject to interpretation. Some things are very, very, very clear, but there are others that a passing comment, somebody overhearing a passing comment between two colleagues who maybe have known each other for a while and have a relationship, they might interpret it one way when the two people didn't interpret it that way at all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some things that are more black and white, but in general, there's a lot of gray in something that I might say to you or vice versa. Right. In the domain of, you know, somebody grabbed my ass, well, that's pretty clear, right? And so to your point, the physical, when a physical thing happens, unless I tripped and fell into you or some obviously accidental thing, it's very clear what happened. You either did a horrible thing or you didn't do a horrible thing. And it seems subject to less interpretation.
I guess I'm not sure. And this is going to – I want to be careful here. I don't know if you had this experience, again, during kind of the heat of the Me Too movement. But I certainly had the following very common thinking. I was, you know, in a lot of different schools working with different, you know, people, teachers, administrators. And I tend to be a relatively physical person. And I thought, wow, man, is it like really, is it inappropriate for me to go, hey, how you doing? And put my hand on their shoulder. Like, I do that with all, you know, different genders, so I'm not discriminating. But I was like, wait a minute, I didn't ask for permission to do that. And I could imagine how under certain circumstances, they'd be like, why, wait, I didn't say you could do that. And so I think even something like a pat on the butt, right? I could see somebody going, well, this is just what this guy does to me. And it's part of the culture. He does it to everybody, you know? But it can be seen as a kind of an harassment and interpreted that way. And I think we've certainly moved into a world now, I think, helpfully, where that kind of sensitivity has been brought into focus more than it was 5 years ago. And so I think, you know, this has come up a lot, and it certainly comes up in the book about, you know, the notion of microaggressions, about these kind of subtle things which have very significant effect on people's stress level. They can be toxic. They can affect the developing child in a very, very significant way as a form of bullying, harassment, discrimination, and oppression. And so I want to be careful because I think this goes back to your core question. It's the interpretation. How does the individual interpret it as an adverse experience? And that's why it's so important to think about the response to the experience. The ACEs are simply a description of the experience and in some ways an interpretation of it. I mean, some of the ACEs, right, we have to be careful here too. Parent incarcerated, there's no interpretation here. Either, you know, dad went to jail or dad didn't go to jail.
Dad going to jail is a traumatic experience.
And it's a traumatic experience, right? Although again, if my dad is my physical abuser, it may be the best relief I've got. And so again, we have to be careful there, right? So dad physically abused me. That's one ACE. Dad going in incarceration, hallelujah. Best thing that ever happened to me, right? The abuse stopped. Mom got separated, divorced, another ACE. But those what are interpreted as adverse are in fact not for that child.
Yes. So thank you for that. There's also feathered throughout the book is sort of insight research into the brain development and therefore the maybe call it life success, because you look at it across different dimensions at different places in the book. But essentially, what I'm getting as a layman is people who experience these adverse childhood events, their brain develops in a very different way that can be problematic. And depending on how many of these experiences they have and how they metabolize them, so to speak, they can end up with very different lives than children that have very few, if any, of these meaningful, horrible events. And so can you maybe, Mark, pop the hood for me on some of that?
Yeah, very good. So I think one of the pieces that I think is an important element of the book is to try to shift the conversation away from the very colloquial use of the term trauma. as well as the more clinical kind of surgical sense of the word trauma, as in post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason for that is the following. As I'm sure you're absolutely well aware, and probably most of the listeners today, there's kind of a viral self-diagnosis going on in many arenas. I think one of the biggest hashtags on TikTok is hashtag bipolar. And certainly we're seeing kids coming into schools self-diagnosing. And that's very, very unfortunate in a lot of ways, because of course those self-diagnoses can actually cause a lot of problems, well, you know, by the diagnosis.
And it was bad enough when we were all self-diagnosing on WebMD. To your point, right. They're self-diagnosing on TikTok.
Exactly. Exactly. So here's the part that I think is an important take-home message, at least for me, and I hope for all the readers. What's been, I think, uncovered by quite a lot of scientific evidence over several decades now, is that different types of adverse experiences, depending on their timing, their tenure, how long they last, their toxicity, their severity, and what I call turbulence, kind of their controllability or predictability, leave different traumatic signatures on the developing child. So, for example, a child that has been severely neglected or deprived, and again, the Romanian orphan cases are really the test case here because this is so well studied over decades, results in different kinds of responses by that developing child. For example, if that child remains in that state of deprivation, let's say from birth through the early teenage years, critical parts of the frontal areas of our brain, often referred to as the executive system, things like attention, self-control, planning, short-term memory, those really fail to develop in a typical way and can be greatly delayed. The essence of what we do in school builds on that foundation. It requires that foundation. Please follow the instructions. Please read this and then tell me what you read. All these things rely on that executive system developing based on experience.
And isn't it a huge part of how we learn to govern ourselves? That is to
absolutely
say, you know, I want to focus on learning this thing, or I feel very angry and I might want to express that anger in a way that is not good at all. And I'm going to accept my anger and take responsibility for my feelings, and I'm not going to do anything about it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are all
– that's right.
We all learn to process life, and we all learn to deal with each other in a way that is successful, that is acceptable, and certainly hopefully mostly legal.
yes.
Because otherwise life doesn't work. And it is the executive function part of our brain that allows us to control ourselves in these ways. Is it not, Mark?
That's right. That's right. And so it's the control piece. It's the attentional piece. It's the short-term memory piece, therefore processing. Right now, this entire conversation, your frontal lobe's been going on full tilt, right? Because you couldn't process this conversation, especially with the speed of information being delivered, if that working memory was compromised. So that is a great piece of machinery that is undermined in development when that child has been deprived or neglected of core experiences. Okay, so that's a signature. And the reason why I mentioned the notion of signature is in part to get doctors on top of this kind of thinking, because they're familiar with what happens in brain damage. When certain areas of the brain are damaged, you get these signatures that are cognitive signatures. There are certain areas of the brain that are related to language. And if those areas are damaged, you get linguistic deficit, but not deficits, let's say, in attention or something else. So the same thing is emerging conceptually in this field where deprivation and neglect lead to this often signature of a delay or even failure to develop executive system. In contrast, abuse leads to something different. In fact, there are different signatures for emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. But broadly speaking, abuse tends to undermine this core area of emotional processing called the amygdala. It's on high alert. And, you know, just as an example, one of the first schools I started working in, I went into a classroom, and as I walked into the class, this little boy, age 12, bolted, ran out of the classroom. I was like, what? What did I do? And the teacher came up to me and says, don't worry about it. You just look exactly like his father who abuses him. And so that hit me so hard that this little child, I triggered in him this fleeing response, which, by the way, is a completely adaptive response. If I've been abused by somebody, you know, so a lion attacks me, I don't go, okay, well, that was John the lion. Any lion will work. I'm getting out of here when lions are around. That little boy did exactly what biology is built into him. If you are going to be threatened by somebody, generalize. Anybody who looks, smells, or thinks like them, get out of here. Okay. So those children who are under situations of abuse, they have a hyperactive alarm system. That system is going bing, 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 bing all the time. And this is why it's so relevant to be talking about children, that frontal lobe system, which has the self-control piece, which you mentioned a while ago, is still very immature. So it can't put the brakes on. So the emotion is outpouring and there's not a braking system to keep it under wraps. So when we work with children like this, we have to both teach them that the generalization isn't appropriate, that I am not scary. So when I work in classrooms like that, first thing I do, I plunk myself down on the ground and I make myself small. And I don't look them in the eye. And I speak in a quiet voice. And I get them used to that before I make any eye contact with them. Or I stand up even. And then once that sense of safety is there, now we can do other things by giving them skills to cope with that bubbling up of emotion, which they're so used to dealing with, but without the skills to calm themselves.
And so there's two pieces,
safety.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but you're going where I hoped you would go, Mark, which is sounds like the beginning of the road to recovery.
Correct. That's right. And the road to recovery is different. And that's why this traumatic signature idea is so important for educators, for nurses, for doctors, for policymakers, that people living with trauma are going to manifest differently depending on the nature of that response. There was a very interesting article in New York Times Magazine section a month or so ago that was about the common misinterpretation legally of people who have been raped, sexually abused. A common response, I guess commonly, often even from judges or prosecutors, is, well, why didn't you do anything? Why did you just sit there and do nothing? The most common response to sexual abuse derives very evolutionarily ancient to prey animals who are subjected to a overwhelming strength of a predator. It's often called tonic immobility. It's going dead. Feign death, because predators will often move away from dead things. And so the article rightly pointed out the science of sexual abuse and tonic immobility, this death feigning, is an adaptive response to being overwhelmed by a dominant predator. A young child being sexually abused by father, an uncle, or some relative is the ultimate in dominance. And so,
don't we also see this in the animal world, where an animal
that's exactly right,
completely frozen, frightened?
Correct.
I mean, I've seen
that's
it with
exactly
my own
right.
eyes and been
that's
surprised
right.
by it. It's like, wow, this animal is going to die.
That's right.
But it can't, it literally can't move.
It can't move. And, you know, there are these interviews. There's a large study that was done on survivors of sexual abuse. And this one woman from Nigeria said, "I lay there like a log." And that's it. There's a deadness. But that deadness then carries through after the sexual abuse has even stopped. There's a deadness. There's a traumatic effect, depending on the timing of sexual abuse, in terms of a critical area of the brain. So a little brain science now.
And so I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Yeah, yeah. This traumatic signatures is important because different types of traumatic events are experienced differently, affect the brain differently, and therefore need to be treated differently. Am I tracking?
You got it exactly right. Okay. And I would add, not just the brain, but the immune system and the autonomic system.
Right, your entire neurology.
Everything. The three core systems of our body are affected by different kinds of adversity.
And there's a I don't know if it is appropriate, you tell me, or a breakthrough here, or at least a shining, a brightening of a light here around A, these different types of traumatic events have different impacts across the whole person, and their treatment and the approach we take to them can't be identical because they're different and impacted different parts of the whole person.
Correct.
Got it.
Exactly correct. And we want to know this because it sets us up to design specific interventions to help people both build resilience and recover from the experiences they had. Now, needless to say, and this is an important piece for everybody to be really clear about, it is not uncommon that people who have one type of adversity have many. And so then you've got a much more complicated problem on your hands because many, many things will be affected, right? So that's important to keep in mind. I mean, that was a true result from the early ACEs studies, that there were something like, 20+% people who had four or more ACEs. So you've got people who are accumulating these ACEs during early development, and that will also build up on the stress system, which will affect the immune system and the autonomic system and the neural system. There was a very, depressingly sad example that Felitti himself brought to bear kind of years after his initial study, but it's an important one that picks up on a theme from today. Sometimes what we see at the surface of somebody does not reveal what's happening under the skin. And here was the example, but this has now been looked at in a number of different studies. A woman contacted him, Dr. Felitti, and said, I was really kind of impressed by the study, and I wanted to share my own history. I'm a circuit court judge. By every measure, a success story. When she was younger, she was pimped out by her grandfather. She is now carrying four different types of cancer. So under the skin, her immune system has been completely devastated, even though she went through college, law school, and made it very high into the legal system. She has suffered dramatically in terms of her immune system. It has been compromised by carrying that stress inside of her. Note, however, in addition, she would have an ACE score of 1.
Wow, fascinating.
And on the cutoff for insurance policy, she would be almost invisible.
Wow.
So this is a sort of a two-point story that we have to be very careful on what looks at the surface. I would remind readers or inform readers, a part comes up in my book as well, Sinead O'Connor, who died very recently. Look at a picture of Sinead O'Connor when she was in her late teens. Her face sparkled with joy. She was being abused by her mother endlessly, relentlessly. And that she carried with her to her grave. And so we have to be very careful about what we see at the surface because a lot of these kids are covering up what's inside. They've learned adaptively to suppress these things. But the immune system is not being suppressed. It's being activated intensely and being damaged.
And so, Mark, if I'm somebody who loves a child who I suspect has had an ACE-like event happen, obviously I'm upset about that, and I want to do everything I can to help mitigate the potential damage of this for this child that I love, what do I do?
So, I mean, this country and many countries, in fact, by most actually, there are child protection services and people can report. And so here's an interesting and again, sort of sad little story. During COVID, when kids were home and not in school, there was about a 50% decrease in reporting at Department of Child and Family Services in the United States. Not because it wasn't happening, but because teachers weren't seeing it to report it. So we have, I believe, an obligation to report. The problem goes right back to your almost first question. Is this an interpretation? And here's where the cross-cultural piece really matters. I work with a lot of kids whose parents come from another country, right? They're immigrants. Jamaican, Cape Verdean, Portuguese, you know, you name it. I see them all day long. If I see a child comes in with a bruise, it is my obligation to ask what happened. That we have to do working in schools. It is our obligation. And if we have reason to believe it came from a parent, it is our obligation to report that.
So, in other words, there's a legal ramification if you do not.
Yes. And there are really concerns, and they're the right ones, because failure to report could mean continued hammering of that child.
Obviously.
Neglect is so difficult because it's by far and away the most common form of maltreatment in one sense. Certainly cross-culturally, worldwide. But the interpretation of that is much more ambiguous. A child comes in with bruises, you're in a pretty safe space of, unless the kid's, you know, says, oh, no, I just fell down the stairs, you know, it was an accident. Repeatedly happening, you got a problem. Child comes in unwashed, dirty clothes, no clothes, emaciated, always hungry, trying to steal food. Okay, now you have some of the telltale signs, right? So those are cases where people working in schools really do have an obligation to report. And it can be uncomfortable. And there's often a lot of discussion and training for staff working in schools to do that kind of reporting. And so, you know, I work in schools with children who are at the high end of the spectrum of, you know, often maltreatment. And it can be much more subtle. And if you're a teacher with 26 kids, your observational skills may not be as good because it's a much greater group of kids. And you may not be as close or in touch with those children. So in the schools I work in, these are small classrooms, 6, 7, 8 kids, and they already come in often with these histories. So it's part of their record, so to speak. But it is an obligation. I think it's an important one that people become aware of it. And part of the reason for writing the book was to bring just greater awareness to the absolute universality, sadly, of adversity so that people can be more aware of what's happening with children. We are living in a world now where, I mean, we're hyper-focused on what's happening in Ukraine and the Gaza. Yes, war is horrific, but right in our backyards, there are children being abused, neglected, and it's not an issue of wealth or race or anything else.
Now there is, you know, part three of your book, there's a lot of hope here.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of experimental things and microdosing and all sorts of stuff that sounds maybe hocus pocusy, but very interesting. Maybe not so hocus pocusy, I don't know. And so maybe touch on, Mark, just some of the recovery methods that are maybe coming out more in recent times that you find most promising?
Yep. So the hopeful piece is, of course, really important. And really, you know, the two core parts of the book are harm and hope. And they have a, you know, a nice handshake. The hopeful piece, what I do in the book is try to really focus on techniques with strong evidence. I, of course, am completely aware of all the therapeutic components. I'm not a therapist, but I appeal to that and talk about therapeutic approaches, which are really important for so many children. The interesting piece about the therapy is that therapy tends to be more umbrella term trauma focus without making these distinctions. And so how do you sort of refine the therapeutic approaches to think about the difference between deprivation, domestic violence, abuse, physical, sexual, emotional, loss of a parent, all these different kinds and the timing of that. So therapy's there. But what I try to do in the book is focus more on other kinds of approaches. And the lens that I take this, I think, can maybe be best illustrated by some of the more newfangled, in some ways, techniques that are at this point largely for adult populations, mostly because the work hasn't been done with younger people. But I do focus on what's happening in the psychedelics revolution. I focus on these techniques called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which are basically ways of turning off or turning on more certain parts of the brain. These techniques are now very strongly validated by scientific evidence. So I don't talk about things that are like, maybe this be kind of cool. These are things now that have.
But it only works on Tuesdays when the moon is half full.
Exactly. I want to be hopeful with things that are backed up by evidence. And part of the reason for that, I should note for those listeners who are in the educational space, is that educators are very familiar with fads. And if you've been around a long time as an educator, like, well, if I just do the ostrich and put my head in the sand, this fad will pass too. So I'm trying to focus on things that I think have real legs because they've been really worked on intensely by the scientific evidence. So let me give, you know, just an example. So I'll give two. One is on kind of the use of biofeedback, which is something that can be done with children, and it links directly to breathing. So there is a aspect of our heartbeats, which is linked to the largest nerve in our body called the vagus nerve. And when we are in a calm and social state, we have high heart rate variabilities. In other words, the variation in timing between the beats is high. There's a lot of variation. When we are stressed or not very social, we have very, very tight and low variance variability. It turns out that you can train for high heart rate variability through biofeedback. And a simple way to do that is to engage in a breathing routine where you breathe in for 5 seconds and breathe out for 5 seconds. And you do that for several minutes. And there are apps for that, as you would imagine there are, and they're free. But you can train up that high heart rate variability. And here's where I think this becomes very interesting. In some studies, they've shown, for example, that dogs have higher heart rate variability than cats. Socially, dogs are more social than cats are. Wolves have lower heart rate variability than dogs. So the domestication process has changed that heart rate variability. Autistic children can be trained with heart rate variability, and it enhances their sociability. So when we work with children who are stressed and not feeling socially engaged, that kind of breathing through biofeedback can greatly help engaging that vagus nerve, increasing heart rate variability, and can help with that stressful, I want to get away from everybody kind of response. So that's one. Again, simple. Doesn't require a lot of technology.
Sounds like one I might want to do a couple times a day. I did a few while you were talking, and I was all of a sudden I was feeling better just having done two or three of them.
Totally. Yeah. And so I think, you know, again, a simple one. The one I would like to just, you know, kind of note, because I think it's a revolution that's happening. I'm sure many of your listeners will have read some of these things. But the revolution in psychedelics, I think, is very important here. And this is important for a couple reasons. The scientific evidence, which is very close to getting kind of FDA approval, the key idea here is different types of psychedelics in coordination with intense therapy. This is not, let's go on a psychedelic ride, let's trip out. It's with a trained therapist of a certain kind. The results that are coming out using psilocybin or MDMA, psilocybin for depression, MDMA for PTSD. Here are the results in a nutshell. These are people who have treatment-resistant depression or PTSD, meaning neither therapy nor therapy with medication has worked for a decade or more. So these are severe sufferers, right? Nothing has worked. They go into a several-week session with either psilocybin and therapy or MDMA and therapy, the latter for PTSD, the former for depression. And these people, after those sessions, are showing massive reduction in the symptoms so that something like 60 to 70% are no longer basically being clinically evaluated as depressed or having PTSD. That is revolutionary. So would it work with children?
I get it. Well, that's exactly where I was going to go. And I can hear a lot of people going, hey, Mark, you know, they're kids, eh?
That's right. That's right. And there are massive ethical issues here. There are also massive policy issues here, right? What many, of course, have already jumped to from reading this is that I'll just get the MDMA or psilocybin myself and do it myself and self-treat. They're missing the point that the therapy is essential here, right? And here's where the neurosciences come in a beautiful way.
Just to put a fine point on it, I mean, are there children today, are there many children today being treated with psychedelics?
I don't know of any.
Don't know of any.
Unless it's under the table. It would be illegal. So first of all, treatment.
So if I had a kid who had some horrible thing happen, da 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 da, and I came to you begging, nothing's worked. We've tried this, that, and the other. And is there a way to? There's no way to do it today in the United States of America.
No, there is not. And I think a couple important points here. We always have to be very wary of things that work with adults, that they will work with children because of the developing body and brain. For example, take, you know, the use of Ozempic for weight reduction, right? These are now being administered to children, and some of the people in policy say, well, we've got some long-term data. The long-term data is a couple of years. No one knows what's going to be like to have effectively a life sentence with Ozempic. When you're 20, no one knows. So we have to be very, very careful here. Here's where some of the technology has begun to be used with younger people and where they're beginning to be some more longitudinal studies. So neurofeedback, where you're basically seeing a monitor of your neural system and you're using that to guide basically what's happening at the neural level. That is safe. You're not injecting anything. You're just basically getting a readout.
So injecting oxygen into the system is okay.
Sure. But I think the neurofeedback is now, again, people like Bessel van der Kolk, who's, you know, very, very important book, The Body Keeps the Score. He has done work with young adults and neurofeedback with children with complex PTSD and has shown some successful results. And so there are things that are coming around the corner. But we have to be very careful here because the signature of what we see, in fact, with children exposed to adversity looks in some cases different than the signature we see with adults who've experienced adversity. And in the same way, therefore, we have to be careful about the treatment pieces. A developing brain is a very, very different brain.
Well, Mark, I could probably talk to you about this stuff for hours. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap?
I guess for me, the final point is that, you know, we've been talking, you know, in kind of numbers and in some ways generalities about populations. You know, I'm very mindful of, and the book is certainly mindful of, individuals. You know, we're talking about individuals with their lives, and the individuals are important in many ways. As anybody who does charitable giving knows, you don't talk about, please help us save a million people in wherever. You talk about John and Sally and Jane, right? And so I always have in the back of my mind, there are these individuals. The individuals are important in terms of just recognizing that it's happening to individuals, but it's also important in terms of individual differences and that we must be very sensitive to those differences if we're going to help people recover. What I find really hopeful is the science has really grown in leaps and bounds, but I don't believe it really is in many practitioners' hands. So for me, this is a message that I want teachers to know about. I want social workers to know about, nurses and doctors and lawyers and people doing policy, because ultimately it's all of those professions that need to come together to help people who are suffering from the adversities they've experienced.
Mark, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for a wonderful new book. And you're welcome back anytime.
I appreciate it. Love the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, brother.
That was the legendary Dr. Mark Hauser. His new book, Vulnerable Minds, The Harm of Childhood Trauma and the Hope of Resilience, is available now. Don't forget, podcasts make great gifts. Share two podcasts you love with two people you love. And make sure you follow us today on your podcast player of choice. We'd like to thank you. We appreciate you for investing part of your life with us. Are you feeling overwhelmed by endless tasks? Hand them off to Bottleneck Distant Assistance. Their dedicated remote professionals take the weight off your shoulders, handling everything from admin to analysis with excellence. Why stay bottlenecked when you could soar? Hire your dedicated distant assistant today at bottleneck.online and refocus your energy on what really matters. Bottleneck.online, affordable support that lets you work smarter. Your website is the first thing people see about you. Is it legendary? Our friends at Atre.net have been building preeminent B2B websites in Silicon Valley for over 20 years. If you're in a B2B tech company and it's time for a rapid relaunch of your site, visit our friends at Atre.net. That's A-T-R-E.net. Are you ready to learn the greatest superpower in business category design? That's where Category Pirates comes in. Learn how to create different futures, design and dominate markets in the first business newsletter written for and by pirates. Go to categorypirates.com today and get your button gear. Today's information is provided to you solely for informational purposes. This oddcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oddcast Network, and it contains content known to the state of California to cause radically non-obvious thinking, new categories, and exponential results. All oddcasts contain nuts, all rights disturbed. Please contact your doctor, lawyer, accountant, yoga instructor, shaman, and category designer before doing anything about anything you hear today. Warning, in California, drivers blocking traffic in the left-hand lane, by law, can receive a $269 fine. So please, don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Everything is the way that it is because somebody changed the way that it was. This episode was produced and edited by me, Jason DeFilippo. Sarah Knox and Jamie J handle our website and technical execution. Show notes by GM Simon. RJ and EX Bobus do our web development. Cedric Biros does our graphic and web design. Our law firm is Weed and Jack. Our accountants are three balance sheets to the wind. We record on squadcast.fm. Joan Jett was right. Listen to The Tragically Hip. Thanks, Candy Dandy. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together. Our deepest apologies go out to Elizabeth Holmes. You may be getting out of jail 2 years early, but we'll never have time for you. Till next time, stay safe, stay legendary, and follow your different.